After his wife died, Mr. Hubert Durden was very anxious to get into her bedroom to have a look around on his own with the door closed and with no one there to watch him and wonder how he was feeling. It was not anxiety or grief or any painful sensation, not longing or yearning or anything like that that drew him to the room, but curiosity. He wanted to look at it.
The room that had hardly existed for him while she was alive, and that he had seldom entered, although he had occasionally stood in the doorway, or at least paused in the doorway to call something into her on his way out of the house.
Rose, I'm on the way out now.
The room now seemed mysterious to him, the way an empty house will suddenly seem mysterious and even frightening to children who never noticed it when it was occupied. And the way a bird's nest lying empty on the ground after a summer storm will crowd the mind with thoughts that have nothing to do with wings and food and warmth and song, but thoughts of vacancy and thoughts of winter and of winds that are too violent and nights that are too dark and thoughts of stony solitude endured in silence and of landscapes that are too cold and too flat and where no one cares to walk.
As long as the door of his wife's bedroom in which he had died remained closed and the room behind it empty, Hubert Durden thought of nothing else.
Why do they think I can't be left alone at this time? I mean my sister and the woman who cleans for me. What do they mean by at this time? It's not a case of this, that, or the other time. At the moment, it's simply before Rose died and after Rose died. And when they say to me, at this time, do they mean I'm never to be left a minute to myself for the rest of my life? Then, before, I was immeasurably free. I was free as a bird. Then, while Rose was alive, I could have wandered up and down the hall in front of that closed door if I'd wanted to. I could have walked up and down there all day long, passing up the hall and passing back. And no questions would ever have been asked. Rose would never have thought of questioning me. I might have said, I just thought I'd take a little exercise or something like that. You might have said,
oh, exercising yourself, if that's what you want to do.
How can I mourn you when I can hardly remember anything about you, apart from the obvious facts that you were gentle, quiet, uncomplaining, beautiful, things like that? How can I grieve for what I can't define, or mourn for what has disappeared without a trace? 40 years, and you made no impression on me. You were always impossible. I often said as much to you. You are impossible. And you said nothing. You gave me nothing. Nothing to be angry about, and nothing to be sad about, and nothing to laugh at, and nothing to wonder at, and nothing at all to remember. You gave me nothing and left me nothing. And by leaving me nothing, you've taken away the one thing that might have been a rock of strength to me now, the rock of grief. I wish I could make a clean breast of things to my sister, to the others. I want them to know what a sham I am. I am a man that can feel no grief, an empty man. Once in your room, I might be able to remember more of you than something humble and busy about the house. Once in there, I might be able to find more to think of than eternal acquiescence. Even the last word you said to me was,
yes.
You always, until that last yes, had to qualify even your yes.
Yes, all right. Yes, if you want to.
All I need is the opportunity to slip into the empty room and be alone there, but without anybody knowing I'm there.
Yes, I don't mind if you like. If you want to, I suppose so, yes. 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 Hello, sir. How can I help you?
Can I have a small packet of cigarettes?
One, two, three, four, five, six.
Isn't that what there usually is?
Oh, I have to count them or my mother'll eat me. A man came in here the other day and took a packet of cigarettes like that. And the next thing I knew, he was back complaining there were only four cigarettes in the packet. And I didn't know what to do. I gave him another instead. And when I told my mother about it, she was angry and she said he'd played a trick on me. So I have to count them now. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I only wanted to tell you that I have to open the cigarettes for everybody, not just you.
Well, I know that. You told me that.
I was afraid I'd hurt your feelings.
Oh, no, no. It isn't that easy to hurt my feelings. I'm Hubert Durden.
Rose.
Mrs. Ramsay's drawing room, cleared for the dancing, seemed enormous. The blue of the curtains put the blue of her dress in the shade, and her dress was velvet too. Rose felt the dress she had made for herself, that had seemed so grand at home, could never compete with the splendour of the curtains. And since she was not competing with the curtains, she felt they protected her. Rose stood waiting for the dance to end. She felt ill at ease, being stranded like this without a partner. She wondered why Hubert Durden had not come in search of her, to ask her for a dance, or to ask her if she'd like to go into the dining room and find something to eat. She recognised the velvet curtains the minute she walked into the room.
Mrs. Ramsay is having her house decorated, her father told her. And many of us working at Ramsay's have been delegated to various tasks in connection with the decoration. I've been given the task of finding the velvet for the curtains. My favourite colour is blue, and I'm hopeful Mrs. Ramsay will go for it.
She was only 9 then. Mrs. Ramsay had been inclined to pick a blue-red, but he had his heart set on a real blue, and he had brought Mrs. Ramsay around to his way of thinking.
He was very proud of his victory. We rejoiced over it. He promised me once the curtains were up, he would get me into the house to see them.
The curtains comforted Rose. It was not the velvet curtains that made the room familiar to her, but the impression that remained of her father's hand.
My father loved me.
This room could never have been his.
As it was now, he'd only dreamed it.
This is my first big party.
She'd been standing there for a long while. If she made her way through the crowd of people, she might find Hubert Durden.
He'll imagine I've come looking for him.
But you didn't want to find him.
Not for one moment would I want him to think that I'd try to find him, or I'd ask him for anything or expect anything from him.
Only last night he'd asked.
Can I see you home from the party?
She was very pleased.
That was only last night.
He'd come down from Dublin on a holiday with a nephew of Father Kane's.
But Hubert was a quiet sort, and he liked to walk by himself and to look around by himself.
And one afternoon, walking like that, he came into the shop and I was behind the counter crocheting for his cigarettes. And for the last week he's been dropping in for an hour or so every evening.
People dancing around on the floor seemed very noisy all of a sudden. The room was too hot. She felt in the short sleeve of her dress for her lace handkerchief, but the handkerchief was not there. It was a present from her mother 4 Christmases ago, and from the day she received it until tonight, it had lain in its tissue paper.
It's gone.
And now it was on the floor under someone's feet.
It'll be a rag by this time.
The only thing to do was get out of the room as quickly as she could.
It can't be helped if Hubert is around the hall and sees me.
She ran up the stairs and began to rummage for her coat. A sound made her turn, and she saw a girl in a bright blue uniform coming out of one of the rooms. It was Mary Lacey, who had gone to school with her.
Oh, Mary! I I never saw you in your uniform before.
Oh, and you in your silks and satins.
Oh, Mary, I made it myself, every stitch, and it's only the cheapest velvet. Nothing like as good as the curtains on the windows downstairs.
Oh, the same old rose. You haven't changed a bit. I remember the day of your poor father's funeral. You came to school. We were all at our desks waiting for the nun to come in, and you said to me, "Oh, Mary, it was a lovely funeral, only for the coffin."
I'd forgotten about the coffin. My mother said, "It's time to close the coffin."
Look, Rose, look at that. Did you ever see the likes of it? It's her dressing table. It's all glass. Only the legs are wooden. Isn't it lovely?
It's lovely.
She began to see her own shadow and then her face in the large oval mirror. Then she saw Mary, who was standing behind her, and the two girls stood watching themselves. We look very mysterious. Don't you think we look mysterious? As if we weren't here at all. Oh, I wish I looked like this always. I wish I could float up and down the main street and I wouldn't care what anybody said about me. I go to Dublin, and then to London, and I wouldn't say anything to anybody. And if anybody said anything to me, I'd say, "I'm Miss Iris Ramsay and I don't like anything." She makes me sick, that one. Her mother is going to do the whole house over for her. She's going to get all new curtains and new paint and new wallpaper everywhere.
They're going to take down all the curtains.
All the curtains, downstairs and up here. She says the place is too heavy and too old-fashioned.
Oh, doesn't matter.
Oh, it doesn't matter. As Mary lay down on the bed, Rose thought of Hubert Durden. The last few evenings when Hubert had been coming to the house every evening, she'd been glad to see him walk in, and happy and excited as long as he was there. But every evening, the minute he stood up to leave, she had wanted to tell him not to bother to come back, and to tell him that she was not depending on his visits. Every time he walked out away from her into the night, she felt like telling him that it meant nothing to her whether he came back or not, and that she would rather he never came back at all than to come back and go off again, leaving her with what was worse than emptiness.
I'd rather have no hope at all, and know there is no chance for me, than to have to contend with this little hope I have that I am ashamed of because it is so little and so timid. Oh, Mary! Wake up, quick. The Sacred Heart lamp has gone out. Please wake up.
Oh, Rose, how long have I been asleep? Was it long?
Only 2 or 3 minutes, Mary. I wouldn't have wakened you, only that the light in the lamp there went out. Mary!
But Mary didn't turn around or look back. She had remembered 100 things to say to Mary, but she had not been able to remember the right thing to say. She knew that if she had been able to take away all the wrong words, she would certainly have found underneath them all the one word that would kill pain, and kill it and make it never come back anymore. There was such a word. She had known it once, and she knew it still. But she could not translate it for Mary.
Father.
He waited alone and watched for Rose to come down the stairs. He had her lace handkerchief in his hand. He had seen it slip from her sleeve as she entered the drawing room, and he had picked it up and put it in his pocket to keep for her. He would have told her he had it, but she had given him no chance to speak to her.
She must know why I continue to appear at her door, making a fool of myself, and not caring that I am making a fool of myself.
Then Rose appeared, coming around the curve of the banisters from the landing above. Hubert thought,
"Lord, what a beautiful house this is. Look at the wonderful staircase they have."
And he watched Rose.
She is immortal, with that fair hair.
I am afraid of the stairs. You look very polite, standing there.
I was thinking I would like to take a bite out of you. You dropped this.
Oh, thank you.
I can't dance. I would have told you before, but I was ashamed. Come along now, Rose. Chin up and step together. If we're not careful, some of the lunatics will trample us under.
Mammy knew what she was about. She took no nonsense from anybody.
I hope you know what you're about, Hubert. It's no joke, getting married. You want to think a bit. And Rose, both. Rose is flighty. She changes her mind from minute to minute. You're a young fellow, Hubert, and I'm older and wiser. And even if Rose is my daughter, I want you to know that I have your welfare at heart just as much as I have hers.
Oh, Mother, don't be talking to him like that. It's not fair. You'll be giving him a bad picture of me. It's not a bit fair.
Maybe it would be a good thing if you stayed away from here for a week or so, Hubert, and gave it thought. And Rose can be thinking too.
I'll be back in Dublin in a week.
I know his mind is made up. And he'll say we'll go together to the priest at the first possible opportunity and arrange to be married as soon as possible.
24 hours.
So be it. It's not long enough, but I can see that you know what you're doing.
Either I'll come back tomorrow night or I won't. I'll sleep on it.
If only he had been there. Father. But he needn't have died. He wasn't old and he hadn't been sick. He had been frail. He often lay down on the bed for a rest, but he hadn't been sick. If he had only managed to hold on for that little bit of time till he got to my birthday, he mightn't have died at all. He would have been safe. It would have been my birthday. It would have been the big day, and he would have been so watchful all day long, thinking about what an important day it was, that he mightn't have lain down for a rest when he came home in the evening. And if he hadn't lain down, he might not have died. We'd both been so busy thinking about the big day and talking about it that we'd paid no attention at all to the days that went before it, except to cross them off the calendar with a pencil. He'd drawn a big, bright red star around the big day. He came in from work as usual that evening, and I stood beside him while he crossed off that day from the calendar.
Will I sit down by the fire, or will I go up and take a rest?
Whatever you like.
Oh, I don't know. I think a little rest. Only one more day now, Rose, and then we'll see what we'll see.
I knew he was referring to the present he had promised me, which was to be a surprise. Then he started up the stairs and didn't look back. Mammy didn't go up to see him as she usually did when she came back to the kitchen from the shop. She was busy getting the tea, and then when it was ready, she said she'd let him sleep on for a while. He died alone. He must have been terribly frightened, but he was very brave. He didn't cry out or call anybody's name. We'd all been downstairs and heard nothing. He could have called out and we might not have heard him. Maybe he tried to call Rose. Rosie! Rose meant that he was calling me, and Rosie meant that he was smiling, calling my name for the second time. There was never any need for him to call me twice. I'd always run to the sound of his voice. He always came into the house calling me. I never found out what he intended to give me for my birthday. He died on the 9th of September, 2 days before my 10th birthday.
But all of that she had to put behind her, because he wasn't there anymore for the next big day.
During those first few weeks together, we lived in a house on Somerville Street, in two small rooms at the top of the house, a long walk to get to them. And Rose grew very fond of those rooms. The day we left Somerville Street, Rose cried. We were moving out into our own place, and all she could do was cry. All she would say when I asked her what was wrong with her was,
I can't help it. Oh, I wish we had stayed where we were. It was so nice there. I wish we could have stayed there.
There's been nothing but mistakes since we got married. Maybe everything was a mistake. The marriage too. The marriage most of all.
That was a miserable day. The first Sunday in the house in Ranelagh. The place looked so cold and bare and hard to deal with. But the worst thing about that unhappy day was the look of terror that crossed Rose's face when he spoke roughly to her.
He was shocked by the terror and hurt on her face. He had only struck out at her in natural annoyance and impatience, but the effect on her was that she was trampled.
She was afraid of me, and she never made any attempt to control the fear, no matter what I said to her. All I ever said to her was that she ought to try to take things easy, try to take life easier, things like that, that would reassure her. When the child was born, she was much happier. But then she made John afraid of me too. I would hear them chattering away. But when I'd open the door and go into the room where they were, they would both fall silent. And when she wanted to reprove the child, she made a habit of saying, "Your daddy doesn't like that, Johnny." As though I, Hubert, the silent father who never spoke an unkind word to the child, as though I was the only one who didn't like what the child was doing. I never could bring myself to say, "You're afraid of me. I don't know why you're afraid of me. I think you ought to make an effort to get over it. It's not fair to me, nor to yourself, nor to the child. I wish you would stop it. All this cringing and running out of the room whenever I walk in will have to stop. It will have to stop. It will have to stop."
Oh, if only Hubert had died, John would never have left me. Never, never, never. He would never have left me alone.
Rose was putting up with setting out the two cups and the two plates and the two saucers and so on. Two of everything. There was no need now to set the table for more than two people. The third place was empty. The third face was missing. John, her son, had left the house and he would not be back. John had gone away to become a priest.
Before, when John was still at home, he'd sometimes be here when he gave me the money.
Every Friday morning, she waited at the foot of the stairs, and on his way to work, Hubert handed her the housekeeping money without a comment.
And the two of us, me and John, we'd exchange a look. Look at the way he treats me, my look said. And John's look said, "I see, I see." Hubert knows no better. We always talked about Hubert. We'd talk about the way he'd come in after work and sit down with the paper, sit down to his tea and go to bed and get up in the morning and do all the things he always did in his routine that never varied.
Now with John gone, there was no one for Rose to exchange glances with. There was no one for her to look at, except Hubert. And Hubert could turn into a raving lunatic, frothing and cursing. And there would be no one to see him except herself.
What on earth? Oh, Hubert, a lovely hyacinth. Isn't that a lovely colour of blue? But it needs water, and I'll put it in a bigger pot. I have a big one out in the shed, the pot the poor rose geraniums died in. I'll get it out after tea. I'll have to find a good place for it where it'll have all the sun.
I had an awkward time with it on the tram, I can tell you. And as luck would have it, I had to stand the whole way home. She's turned into a different person. In the presence of strangers, she sometimes takes to smiling. One minute she produces a smile of trembling timidity, as though she has been told she'll be beaten unless she looks pleasant. And then again, a minute later, there'll be a grimace of absurd condescension on her face. If she does speak, she tries to cover her country accent with a genteel enunciation that is vulgar. It's better to leave her where she feels at ease, at home. She isn't up to the mark. She isn't able to learn how things are done or what to say. She has no self-confidence, and her feelings are too easily hurt. It's very hard for a man in my position to have to be ashamed of my wife, but there it is. I'm ashamed of her. But her failure isn't her fault. She was born the way she is. There's nothing to be done about it.
Oh, Hubert, a lovely hyacinth, a lovely colour of blue. A lovely colour of blue. Of blue. Blue.
Oh, if only Hubert had died, John would never have left me alone.
The realization that John had gone and would not be back took different shapes inside her. But it always stayed in the same place, just under her chest, in the center, between her ribs. Out of this recurrent delirium, two daydreams had grown, and both ended at the moment when John became her own again, only hers.
John, put that suitcase down. It's a terrible weight. I knew you'd come back to me, John.
You always knew what was best for me, Mother.
Come into the kitchen. I've the table set and ready with everything you like.
But, Mother, didn't you mind when I was away? Didn't you miss me at all? You never said one word, not a word.
You noticed my silence, John. You really did. I didn't say a word. I kept back all the reminders and reproaches I wanted to let loose at you. But you have to understand how brave and unselfish I was, letting you go off free as I did. Have some more tea, John.
But it was all a dream. He wasn't coming back. The second dream she had of John was a very simple one. It was more of a vision than a daydream, and all that really happened in it was that she saw his grave. He'd not got away at all. He had died.
It wasn't his fault after all. He didn't want to leave me.
She visited his grave every day and sat beside it for hours and wore black like a widow. Everyone marvelled at her devotion when they saw her going to the grave every day. Hail, rain, sleet or snow, no matter how she felt. Bringing flowers and leaves and ferns according to the season of the year. She was arranging Christmas holly and ivy on John's grave when she heard Hubert's key in the lock.
He would go into the back sitting room and light the fire there and sit beside it until she called him to tea.
I'm after forgetting to bring the coal scuttle into the sitting room.
She wouldn't give him the chance to come down and ask for it, or watch her clamber with it up the three steps that led to the hall and the sitting room.
He turned when she came in, and the newspaper billowed toward the fire and blazed up. He dropped the paper in his fright.
I'll just push the newspaper into the grate.
That's all right. I'll get some water.
The fire turned into black soup, which streamed out between the bars of the grate and down onto the tiles of the hearth, where it settled into puddles of various sizes and shapes. This was the worst thing Hubert had ever done, and John wasn't there to see it.
Oh, what will I do?
Oh, for God's sake, pull yourself together. What ails you? No harm done.
What ails me? It's what ails you coming in here setting fire to the grate with nothing in it but paper. You couldn't come down to the kitchen and ask me for coal. Oh, no, not you. You'll wait till it's brought up to you and burn the house in the meantime.
You shut up. Do you hear me? Shut up before I say something you won't want to hear.
First you drive away my son out of the house, and then you try to burn the place down around my ears, around my ears.
I suppose I should have tried to burn the place down while he was still in it. It was you gave me a fright, clumping in here with your Mother of Mercy face and banging the coal down on the floor so that I dropped the paper. It was you did it with your spite and bad temper.
Me with my spite and my bad temper? It's your fault. You with your stupid little habits and your wanting to be waited on hand and foot day and night. And the way you treated my son. I'll never forget the thing you did with his holy picture at tea time. The one he'd prop up against the sugar bowl. Putting it on your bread and smoothing it with a knife as if it was butter. And then biting it. And then you sat there chewing it and smiling your happy family man smile. John cried, he really cried, and you just pretended you didn't know what you'd done wrong. I was so scandalised, and I said that to you, and all you could reply was, I'm fed up with the two of you.
Come on now and cheer up, and stop making a show of yourself over nothing.
Over nothing, is it?
If John was here, he'd tell you. John would stand up for me. John knew how hard I worked, working and slaving to keep the place nice and clean, and you call it nothing. But what do you care? You never cared about me, and you never cared about him, and you ended up driving him out of the house.
I'm going to tell you something, Rose. You won't like it, but I think it's time you learned. Do you know who really drove John out of the house? Answer me.
I thought you did.
You thought what it suited you to think. No, I didn't drive John out. We never got along, but that was because you made it your business to see that we didn't get along. You drove him out yourself. It was to get away from you. That was all he wanted. You wouldn't even let him go to school by himself. He couldn't go on the tram by himself, like the other boys, until the priests told you to leave him alone. And when he went to work, you were down there at lunchtime half the time, weren't you? He got so that he was ashamed to be seen with you. A month before he left, he told me he was leaving, but he didn't tell you till the very last minute, because he knew you'd find some way to stop him. And he was bound and determined to go. How do you like that? Tell me. How do you like that little piece of information? He told me first.
If he got ashamed of me, he got that from you.
Oh, of course you'd have to say that, of course. You can't face the facts. But I've had to face facts. He was sick of you, and I'm sick of you. Sick of your long face and your moans and sighs. I wish you'd get out of the room. I wish you'd go. Go on, go away. I don't want any tea. All I want is not to have to look at you any more this evening. Will you go?
Oh, I will. I'll go. Indeed, I will. Only to get away from you, that's all I ask.
She felt free.
Free.
She felt very independent.
Independent.
She was astonished.
Astonished.
Astonished at her former anguish and helplessness, and at the importance she had attached to the house and all its little furnishings, when all the time she had really wanted to do was to run away as far as she could go. What she had in mind was to borrow enough money from Father Carey to pay her way to where John was.
Borrow enough.
Once she saw John again and talked with him, she'd be on sure ground.
On sure ground.
She would find some kind of work. Maybe even in the seminary.
Some kind of work.
She was surprised all of this hadn't occurred to her before.
If Hubert hadn't thrown me out, I could never have left. Nobody can blame me. I did the only thing I could do. Someday I hope Hubert will be ashamed of himself, but by then it'll be too late. It's too late now.
It was dark, except for the light coming from the street lamps and the occasional dim glare of light from the trams as they passed. It was the time of evening when nearly everybody was at home.
Father Carey, you'll understand. Father Carey, I need money to get to John. He needs... No, no, no. He'll think I'm making it all up or that I'm making an excuse of some little incident to spite my husband and to get my son. In either case, he'll disapprove. He'll tell me to go back to him.
She looked at Sandford Road, where trams and cars and bicycle and people moved steadily. She gazed down Eglinton Road at all the lighted houses as far as she could see. But she was really thinking of the place where John was and of the town where she had been brought up. And she was this seeing the future that had once lain before her, full of light, reflecting heaven, that was now opaque and blank like fear, and reflected nothing.
Reflected nothing.
When she unlatched the gate, the front door opened and Hubert peered out.
Rose, listen to me a minute. I'm awful sorry about what I said to you. I don't know what got into me. I had no right to say what I did.
Doesn't matter.
Oh, it does matter. Forgive and forget.
I'll forgive you because that's what John would want me to do. But I didn't come back for his sake. I came back because it's my duty to stay here and keep your house.
Have it your way. Maybe someday your precious John will have his own parish and you can go and keep house for him. Then you'll have him all to yourself. All to yourself. Maybe then you'll be satisfied.
She kept going back in her head to Hubert's remark about her keeping house for John. Sometimes people said more than they meant to say. It might be a long time, but she could wait. If anything happened to Hubert, she could manage John's house for him.
If only Hubert would die.
That evening, she made a decision.
I'll never again share a room with Hubert Durden.
And once her mind was made up, there would be no going back on it.
No, not ever.
I've been north and I've been south and I've been east and west. I've been just a rolling stone. Yet there's one place on this earth I've always liked the best. Just a little town I call my own. For Dublin can be heaven with coffee.
For the fifth day in a row, there had been no rain. And in Dublin, even in June, that was unusual. When closing time came in the men's outfitting shop on Grafton Street where he worked, and he saw the golden evening, he thought he might walk all the way home instead of taking that long ride out in the tram, even if it meant being late for tea. He thought of mountain paths and tangled woods and narrow roads that ran between green fields. He imagined himself wearing a heavy pullover and walking steadily, but not in the direction of home. All the time he was thinking about walking, he was hurrying to get his place on his usual tram. And in the end, he turned his own corner and walked past the neighboring houses to his own front door and turned his key in the lock at the same time as always. There had been only a second of time and hardly more than a line of light that narrowed to a thread and then vanished. He might as well not have seen Rose at all, but he had seen her. And he wondered if it could possibly have been intentional to shut the door in his face like that.
The tea is ready.
I don't want any tea.
What's the matter? Why don't you want your tea?
I don't want any tea. That's simple enough, isn't it? And I can guarantee you this. The next time you shut a door in my face like that, I'm going to walk out of this house and I won't come back. I mean what I say.
Hubert, I don't know what you're talking about. Will you let me bring you up a tray?
Never mind about the tray. I don't want your tray. If you'd only get out of here and leave me alone. If I'd followed my original plan and walked home, then I wouldn't have seen the door close. If only I hadn't seen it close. But I did see it. And having seen it, I had to take a stand. I should have gone down to the kitchen and had it out with her the minute I saw the door close. Nothing in my life makes sense. Poor Rose. By her presence, she shows what I've tried to do and what I'd hoped. And by her behaviour, she shows what my hopes have come to. I'm ashamed of her. Without Rose, who knows what I might have done?
A Dublin can be heaven with coffee at 11 and a stroll.
I always have my breakfast by myself and my dinner in town in the middle of the day. So there are only tea times and dinners to get through.
He knew she was defenseless, and he felt that his indifference left her exposed, even though she didn't know about it. And he pitied her, because in her own way, she did her best, and nobody cared at all about her. She was a lost cause, all right.
A lost cause.
And it was a good thing that only he knew it.
It would be terrible for her if the rest of the world knew what he knew about her. She had no sense. She was not able to take care of herself. She had always been the same.
Rose had not always been the same.
Rose had not always been the same.
But there was no one now to tell her what she had
been. But there was no one now to tell her what she had been.
Or to see her as she had been seen.
Or to see her as she had been seen.
Once in a while, she thought about her father.
Once in a while, she thought about her father.
Father. He died when I was 10. I knew he was dead. But not that he was gone. I refused to believe that he was gone. He'd expect that of me. He said I was to be faithful. once when he was dancing me round the kitchen, showing off, he said, "One of these days, Rose is going to show us how the birds fly."
Tell me something. You remember the hyacinth I brought you one time. What became of it?
The blue hyacinth? It did very well after I put it in the big pot. I showed it to you. It had a lovely bloom.
And where is it now? Did you put it out in the garden?
Oh, no. Hyacinths go, Hubert. They only have one season. You have to get new bulbs every year.
I'll get you another one. I'll get it for you tomorrow. I'll bring it home with me tomorrow night.
Oh, you'd never find a hyacinth this time of year. Only in the spring you get hyacinths, and this is September.
Oh, I see. I forgot for a minute.
I'm sorry, Hubert.
It's all right.
What put the hyacinth into your mind?
Nothing. I just happened to think of it.
Will you light the fire for me, and I'll go on down?
I'll light it. Go on. Go on, do whatever you have to do. There is nothing more to be said. There is nothing more to be said because what remains to be said must not be said. It is too late for Rose.
Hubert was silent. He had nothing to say, and in any case, there was no one to hear him.
Yes.
Hubert found himself alone in the house one afternoon. There was nothing.
Nothing.
Not even a perceptible emptiness.
Not even.
It was her room, but she was not in it anymore.
The room said nothing.
Nothing.
It was a general emptiness that filled her place. He might as well have been looking into a fallen nest to try to discover the nature of what was not.
There was no resistance in the room.
No resistance.
He felt let down, as he had when he was a child and Christmas was over.
Christmas over.
You would think, Hubert thought, to see her chocolate boxes that they contained something of interest or value.
Old bills marked, paid 30 years ago. Recipes for dinners never cooked. Dinners so elaborate she must have been dreaming of a visit from the King and Queen of England. Directions for making dresses she would never in her life had the occasion to wear. Bits of tweed, bits of serge, bits of velvet, bits of suiting and coat materials. Dreaming, 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 always dreaming. And what was it she dreamed about all her life? She never said. If you asked her what she was thinking about, she'd say,
"Oh, nothing. Oh, nothing. Oh, nothing."
Still, he could not believe that even a human being as ineffective as she had been could vanish without leaving any trace of herself at all.
Any trace would be a sign that might guide him to the grief he wanted to suffer for her.
But there was no sign.
No sign. I had no idea how bad you were. I went into your room when you didn't turn up as usual at 9 o'clock sharp with my breakfast tray. You were lying in bed doing nothing. It was a long time since I saw you lying in bed. What are you doing in bed, Rose?
Nothing. I have a terrible pain in my chest.
Will I call the doctor? He can have a look at me too, as long as he's here. Will I call the doctor then or not? I think I'll call him anyway for myself. Do you want me to call him?
Yes.
Yes, you said. When he came and went into the room, all there was left to say was that it was over for you.
Now, Hubert thought, there was no use staying in that room any longer.
There was nothing to be found there.
I remember the night I asked you to marry me. We were standing together on a small stone bridge that overlooked a river outside the town where you lived. I hadn't intended to ask you that night. I meant to keep you wondering a little longer, not to let you get too sure of yourself. But all of a sudden, I turned to you and said, I thought we might get married. You continued looking down into the flowing water, and you didn't answer me. I said, I was wondering if you had thought of me at all. You still said nothing and didn't raise your head. Rose, please, for God's sake, will you marry me? You raised your head and looked at me and you said, yes. And that was all you said.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I can see your face as you looked then. I can see your face, and in your face, all the promises that your face showed me, the promises that haven't been fulfilled. Your walk, your step was brave and free and definite. I fell in love with you for the exact qualities that were not yours at all. It was not your fault I was mistaken in you. You shone at a distance, but close to, you ceased to shine. You're gone. You were good. I wish I could miss you.
When his sister returned home and found the door to Rose's room standing open, she said,
I see the door of the room is open.
I thought it had been closed long enough. We can't make a shrine out of a room.
Did you go into the room?
Yes, I went in there. There's nothing in there.
He put his hand up in front of his face and started to cry. His sister started to cry too, and she went out of the room and was back in a minute with a cup of tea for him. He refused the tea. And when she suggested calling the doctor, he refused to see the doctor. He would not take his hands from his face, and he would not get up and go into his bedroom and lie down, and he would not do anything except cry. The tears did not run down his face and away. They poured all over him and stayed on him and encased him. And when he tried to stop crying, they poured out all the more, and there seemed to be no end to them. The tears had him in a straitjacket, and he could not speak. The tears hurt him and covered him with a pain that seemed to grow more unbearable every minute. But what hurt most of all was his inability to tell his sister that he was not crying for Rose, because he really and truly felt no grief for Rose, but that he was crying for the lack of grief, because surely Rose had deserved more than a casual dismissal from life. And that most of all, he was crying simply and solely because he was sad. He was sad and he was crying, and that is all there was to it. But he could not speak to tell his sister that it was all only a masquerade and that he was only a sham of a man. And after a long time, when he finally got command of himself, it no longer seemed worthwhile to tell her. And the way it worked out, he never told her. And never told anybody.